Forbidden Panel welcomes you to Panelcast, Forbidden Panel's weekly podcast featuring movie and comic news and reviews. And now, your hosts, AJ and Brian.
Hey everyone, this is Brian and welcome to the Panelcast.
And this is AJ, and say hello to episode 85.
I'm going to be reviewing a ton of zombie books this week.
While I review Daredevil Reborn and Essex County.
So let's take a quick break and we'll be right back with the news.
Hey, how's it going? This is Derek from Pulp Fiction in Long Beach, the world's biggest selection of graphic novels and comic books. Check out our website at www.cheapgraphicnovels.com, and you get all your graphic novels at 40% off cover price.
How much?
45% off cover. Even better than 40%. And we can ship it to you anywhere in the United States. Again, check out www.cheapgraphicnovels.com, or if you're in Long Beach, California, check us out at Pulp Fiction.
1742 Clark Avenue, Long Beach, California.
We got manga, we got anime, we got back issue comics, current comics. We'll put you on the pull list, give you a good discount. Graphic novels, figures, toys, the whole shebang. Check us out, because we rock. Pulp Fiction and CheapGraphicNovels.com. Booyah.
Hey everybody, welcome back to Panelcast, the long-awaited 85th episode. We kind of took a little month hiatus there between episodes, which apparently we do a lot.
Yeah, it didn't feel like we were gone that long.
It didn't, but it did. So we apologize for the long break. Hopefully we'll try and make it not so often. The distance between recordings and whatnot. So, having said that, let's move on forward with the new section of our show. Brian, why don't you go ahead and lead us off?
Well, it looks like the whole turmoil over the Superman lawsuit is still ongoing. The latest bit that there is there's apparently some documents were stolen from the attorney for the Siegel family, who I guess they tried to actually go and get the documents back. Somebody stole the documents and anonymously delivered them to Warner Brothers, who is the one that actually filed the suit. They tried to get that information back, and the judge just ruled that those documents are not actually protected by attorney-client privilege because the lawyer apparently didn't fight a grand jury subpoena that was issued during the investigation. So looks like this whole business is getting even more convoluted every time some new little bit comes up.
It just seems like it's going to be an ugly, ugly battle, like, honestly.
Well, it's already pretty much an ugly, ugly battle. So now it's just both sides are basically stating that the other side is just trying to do it for the money. And it is right now, from what I understand, the suit that Warner Brothers filed in 2010 was that the attorney for Mark Toberoff, the attorney for the Siegel family, was attempting to coerce the heirs of Siegel and Schuster to actually file the lawsuit in an attempt to gain money for himself. That's what they're alleging. So there's actually a number of lawsuits being kind of tossed back and forth, and this is just the latest shenanigans in the whole mess.
Wow. Well, you know, speaking of Superman, Russell Crowe is reportedly in negotiations to take up the role of Clark Kent's Kryptonian father, Jor-El, in the Zack Snyder-directed film Man of Steel for Warner Brothers Pictures. Producer Christopher Nolan has been seeking a major name for the role for some time, and now he's scored him with Crowe, who is the final choice for a part both Sean Penn and Clive Owen had also been considered for. Many of you may remember the original Superman, where Jor-El was portrayed by Marlon Brando, and then recently the voice of Jor-El was portrayed by Terrence Stamp. So, you know, Russell Crowe has got a lot of big shoes to fill when he comes in. Harry Cavill, Amy Adams, Kevin Costner, Diane Lane, and Michael Shannon are all set to star in the film, which begins shooting in August.
Well, Crowe's certainly surly enough to do it.
Yeah, and I can see him pulling it off. I mean, when Marlon Brando pulled off the role, yeah, he had the white hair and everything, but he wasn't necessarily old. He was still a young guy, thin, in shape. You know, he looked great for the role. So I think Russell Crowe would blend in nicely, depending on how the film is shot.
Well, it looks like Lock and Key, while it's still kind of up in the air as to whether or not it's going to become a series, people attending Comic-Con will at least get a chance to see the pilot. So it's being reported that Joe Hill is going to be bringing the pilot to screen at San Diego Comic-Con this year. Unfortunately, there's not any word out there as to whether or not Sci-Fi is going to pick it up. It has been rejected by Fox as of last month, so it's still not looking too good for Lock and Key to become an actual series, but, you know, at least people are going to get a chance to see it in film.
Which, again, is a real shame, because, I mean, the comics are great, and I can see it doing okay on Sci-Fi. I'd like to see it over on FX, though.
Yeah, I mean, I guess, you know, now that they've got the pilot, they can still kind of take it around and shop it around. They might have to reshoot a lot of things. From what I understand, some of the sets that were originally used have already been dismantled, so they probably would kind of have to start over, and there might end up being some recasting as far as that goes, but maybe they can generate enough buzz at Comic-Con to get this series moving forward.
So moving on with more DC properties, Anne Hathaway is pushing herself to limits on the set of Dark Knight Rises, and it's proving to be something of an issue for the costume designers. Ace Showbiz reports that Hathaway is doing a lot of her own combat stunts. However, the costume materials and the physical combat have led to a little problem, and not just the stuntman's black eye she caused last week. This time, the harm is to her modesty. Before going further, let me explain what happened last week. Anne Hathaway was on the set shooting a scene for the film, and accidentally broke a guy's eye socket.
Oh, shit.
She got so into the role, you know, she took the guy's weapon away from him and popped him in the eye socket, which was part of the film, but not necessarily in real life, so...
Right.
An insider says Anne was filming a very similar fight scene when her costume split right open, right on her bottom. She's putting everything into this role, both physically and emotionally, and the wardrobe department is paying the price. She must have gone through a dozen costume changes due to throwing herself around. So Christian Bale and Tom Hardy will likely be pushing things as well, with Comic Book Movie reporting the rumor this week that the famous scene of Batman getting his spine broken over Bane's knee in the comics will be recreated here for the pair's first fight scene. Yeah, so, I mean, hearing all this stuff, as bad as I feel for the people that are enduring it on the set, makes me all giddy inside, because, you know, just goes to show...
it sounds like all the actors are really getting, you know, throwing themselves into the role.
Right, and they're doing the best to provide as much realistic
literally,
content
as well as
for the movie, you know, as much as Heath Ledger did in the first film, so... I'm very excited about that.
So it seems as though Lord Eddard Stark was stabbed over the weekend. Actor Sean Bean apparently got into an altercation in North London with somebody at a bar who later returned to the bar and attacked him and then stabbed him. I believe he was stabbed in the arm with broken glass. But he declined to actually go to hospital and decided to go back into the bar and continue drinking. It was patched up with a first aid kit that was kept in the bar. And it also looks like he is not going to be pressing charges over the stabbing as well. So, I guess maybe somebody was a little bit mad with the way that the latest episode of Game of Thrones turned out, or could have been something else.
Who knows? But, you know, He's pretty much a badass anyway, so he's probably still in character. So talking to the Hero Complex Film Festival on Halloween on Sunday via Slash Film, actor Robert Downey Jr. and director John Favreau revealed that the upcoming Iron Man 3 faces some storytelling difficulties due to the events that will take place in the Avengers. While Shane Black takes over the directing duties on the third Iron Man, Favreau is still helping with the storyline and says, I guess in comics you can say that it's an individual storyline and you can break it off into a group, but in movies it's hard not to take that in consideration, what just happened. What are you going to say? They all just lost their cell phones and you can't get help? So it's going to take a lot of ingenuity to make it make sense in the mainstream film audience as well as comic book audiences. Downey, meanwhile, praised the Avengers, saying, I just thought, how are you going to put all of those clowns together? He's wearing a suit. He's all jacked up. He's so-and-so. And poor Mark Ruffalo, he's going to outdo us. And we're about 6 weeks in, and I have to say Joss Whedon is nailing it, Downey Jr. said. He's so smart and so good, and it's going to be great. I can't believe I just said it. I can never believe this, but it's going to be great. So, yeah. At least they're trying to keep some sort of continuity within between the movies, you know, not just jumping all over the place, and much like, you know, Wolverine and the X-Men and all that. So that's still pretty cool.
Yeah. Well, hopefully it'll turn out better than Wolverine and the X-Men.
Well, you know, I enjoyed the new X-Men, but it had nothing to do with the comic books. It was all related to the movies, so you know, you got to take it for what it is.
So some big news with Comic-Con for this year. People are probably going to notice that there's some really big names that are missing. Warner Brothers, Disney, and the Weinstein Company, and DreamWorks have all decided not to really have big presentations at Comic-Con 2011. So in a way, I think that probably actually might be a good thing, because it seems in the past few years that I went that it really was starting to get to a point where the big studio names are kind of overshadowing everything else.
Right. And it made it increasingly difficult to move around and get to where we wanted to go, including the Artist Alley, which was left
right
a barren wasteland because of all the big studios that were out there.
It also seems, too, like it's a good move on Disney's part with their recent acquisition of Marvel, because it seems like basically what they're going to do, at least I'm hoping this is what their goal is to kind of step back their presence in that method and try to push Marvel a little bit more.
But unfortunately, films like Twilight will still have a presence there.
Well, unfortunately, films like Twilight have a presence anywhere.
You shut up. You take that back.
No.
Those aching to see the live-action Star Wars TV series are going to have to wait a few more years, it seems. Producer Rick McCullen confirms to Check Position that the TV series is on hold. It has to do with the episodes being so ambitious. Basically, it's like The Godfather. It's the Empire slowly building up its power base around the galaxy. What happens in Coruscant, which is the major capital, and its group of underground bosses who live there and control drugs and prostitution. He goes on to explain the show's current status. We have 50 hours of third draft scripts, but the problem we have is a lot of digital animation. We don't have the technology yet to be able to do them at a price that is safe for television. Since we would be financing them, it'd be suicide for us to do this. So we're going to have to wait 3 or 4 years. Now, I don't know what to feel about this. I mean, you know, I really want to see a Star Wars live action TV series. I think it'd be kind of cool. And I think if they did it, they'd be able to pull off a lot of storylines that would be rushed, would it be in movie form, or, you know, have Jar Jar Binks running around for 2 hours. So, you know, in that aspect, I'm glad that they need to take the time to develop it better, to get the special effects down packed and all that stuff. But I'm still a little anxious to see it. I mean, at the end of the day, no matter how bad the original, the remake trilogy was, the prequel trilogy, that is, I'm still a Star Wars fan, so I'll always be geeking out when it comes on.
Yeah, I still generally like Star Wars, although probably not as intensely as a lot of other people. I have to say that I think I'm actually more excited about the new MMO that's coming out than anything.
Yeah, that should be kind of cool too.
So, I bet people have been a little deprived of listening to me rant about Blue Water.
Here we go.
So I figured I'd give everyone a little bit of a treat.
Welcome back to Blue Water, guys.
Yeah, so I got 2 Blue Water stories this time, and yeah. They're doing a Steve Jobs comic, which should be absolutely fascinating. I don't even like... Okay, I don't really get into the whole, like, Apple versus PC thing, because, I mean, I personally don't use Apple products myself, but I don't really care. I mean, they both have their plus and their minuses, you know, they both have things that they're good at and things that they're not good at. Fine, whatever. But I don't understand this whole fascination with Steve Jobs and, like, why this guy's idolized so much. And so it just, You know, this is another thing where it's like, somebody out there is probably going to read this comic, and, you know, that's basically all Blue Water wants to do, is they want to sell comics to everybody who's going to buy them. But I just don't understand what there is about Steve Jobs that's worth putting into a comic book.
It's Blue Water. It don't matter.
Yeah. Really, I shouldn't be surprised anymore. I mean, I honestly shouldn't. The other one makes a little more sense. They're also doing part of their Fame series for Ryan Reynolds, which, you know, considering the fact that he's a Green Lantern and kind of sort of Deadpool, I don't really know where that thing's going, but... I mean, I could see it from that aspect. Like, they're kind of jumping on the, you know, Ryan Reynolds as the Green Lantern thing.
Yeah, but, I mean, do they really have right to talk about Ryan Reynolds doing...
Well, no. They don't have the right to talk about anybody, honestly.
But, I mean, like, through the fact... Licensing rights, through the fact that he's wrapped in the Green Lantern DC properties right now, and they can't really discuss about that movie or the Deadpool movie because of Marvel, and Disney owns that.
Well, so, they get around that by... essentially, you know, doing it sort of like, you know, claiming that it's like a biography. So they can talk about other people's properties and stuff like that from a sort of, I guess, a journalistic standpoint. They don't really have to have permission to do what they're doing. And I mean, like, we've had stories before where we talked about different court cases that Blue Water has been involved in where they essentially, you know, it was stated that they have permission to do what they're doing. So... I don't foresee any problems with this particular one. Actually, I think they probably would have more issues with the Steve Jobs comics because, honestly, I mean, the guy's kind of litigious, and Apple likes suing everybody. So I would honestly see this one causing them more problems than the Ryan Reynolds thing.
I know, but I'm just saying.
I mean, I don't want to read a comic about either one, so...
Absolutely agree with you on that one. Matthew Fox, Ed Harris, and French actress Julia Levy-Boken are in talks to join Mark Forster's World War Z for Paramount Pictures and Skydance Productions, says Deadline. An adaptation of the Max Brooks novel, the story looks back on the global zombie infestation 10 years after the epidemic. Brad Pitt, Morell Enos, and James Badgedale also star. Here's something that'll make you all happy. World begins production this month, after a long period in which Paramount struggled with a $125 million budget, with the studio needing to fill a gap in its summer 2012 schedule. That will likely happen when Star Trek II moves. World War Z is now looking like a viable alternative. So the cast is looking to be sizing up pretty well, and the fact that they're beginning production this month has to have Max pretty excited about it. So...
It has me pretty excited about it.
Me too, because I've been waiting for this movie for a decade now. But again, if you can't,
or thereabouts.
If you can't wait for the movie and you're anxious, pick up the audiobook. It's awesome.
Yeah, definitely. If they can bring at least that much, you know, production quality to the movie, it'll be a fantastic movie.
Yeah, absolutely agree. So, there you have it, Brian.
Okay, well, why don't we go ahead and take a quick break, and then we'll be right back.
Absolutely. But let me – oh, I forgot. Let me quick toss one quick thing in there before we go. For those of you that are fans, the second season of AMC's The Walking Dead has set a premiere date of October
21st. Yes!
So October 21st, make sure you're close by the TV because we will be watching season 2. So yeah, quick break, and we'll be right back.
Hi, this is Brandy Ossett, Reiki Master Teacher and High Priestess, and also author of The Goddess Guide. Please visit my website at brandyossett.com for information on all things spiritual and mythological.
The white man, the books, no, and all that shit.
Man. No, fuck the blind man.
Fuck the blind man, the books, and all that shit.
killed this nigga in the head.
You killed my nigga in the head, man.
And that was the reaction to this week's episode of Game of Thrones. Yeah, sorry
if that last bit
offended anybody out there, but...
Hey, we have, you know, the explicit tags on our thing, so people should know by now. We're not above any sort of profanities and whatever.
No.
I crack up every time I see that clip.
I know. Like, I was hard holding back the laughter while we were recording that bit.
Man, that guy is not happy.
No, that was if you want to actually see the clip, you can go on YouTube. It's from Otaku Assemble. He's a reviewer that goes online after each episode of Game of Thrones to review it and give his opinion of what happened and catch everybody up on it. So that was his reaction after the end of this week's episode. So, spoiler alert!
Right. Something big happens.
Something big happens, and we're going to discuss it right now. If you don't want to hear it, skip to the next section of the show. All right, so, Brian, why don't you take it? Why don't you lead us into it?
Okay, so, this last weekend, last Sunday, Game of Thrones episode number 9 aired. It's the second to last episode, the penultimate, and so, basically, you know, throughout this series, there's been a lot of different storylines because if anybody out there is not familiar with either Game of Thrones or the book series, A Song of Ice and Fire, that it's based off of, there is a lot of really intricate storylines that deal with, you know, there's a lot of, sort of like the sword fighting kind of, you know, fantasy element to it. But there's a lot of politics. There's a lot of intrigue, a lot of things going on in the background as different characters interact with each other, and a lot of storylines kind of come together and separate, and there's so many different threads to follow. It's a really complex series. So episode number 9 sees a lot of the storylines that have been going for this season starting to come to a head. But the thing that really caught everybody off guard that has been following the series but has not read the books is... they didn't really realize that in Game of Thrones, none of these characters are safe.
None.
Nobody is safe.
Absolutely none.
And that's one of the things that I love about George R. R. Martin's books, is that they're a little bit slow to get through because they're, for one, they're pretty hefty books. You know, these are like Stephen King-sized books, but there's so much more intricate detail in terms of what's going on. So it really does take a little while to get through. But they're such fascinating books because, one, just the interactions between all the characters. I mean, some of these people are fucking brutal, the Lannisters especially. But George R.R. Martin doesn't pull any punches, and people will die when you least expect it. And that's – I'm glad to see that this whole element carried over into the TV series because I was worried they were going to kind of tame a lot of things down. But so far, they haven't disappointed me at all. And – yeah, so a lot of people were not expecting this to happen, but Lord Eddard Stark has died.
Yeah,
he was killed off.
You know, and I've gone on record to say multiple times I've yet to read the series at all. I had a good friend of mine who recently passed away, and he was a huge fan of the series, and he would just tell me off bat. He's like, you know, he makes it hard to get behind a character or invest in a character because the next thing you know, they're dead. And so I knew walking into the series not to be surprised when, you know, a majority of these main characters that you see are going to die. But to hear this kind of reaction come out of the fans, first off, it's funny as hell to me. It cracks me the hell up. Second off, it's a tribute to the writing of the show, that this is how good the show is, that here we are on the 9th episode, and you're so invested in these characters that when one of them dies, you throw a fit like this. I mean, you just
it invokes
such a heavy emotion out of you that you know this person here had decided to share that bit with everybody to have this reaction, this outburst. That's a tribute to the show. That tells you that the show is good.
It is.
That's how awesome it is. That it just involves you and wraps itself around you so. So it just engulfs you, you know. I mean, there's nothing you can do about it, and it's awesome. I love it.
I have to say too, with this series, that you know, in terms of my opinion of how well I think the series is done, is that I already had to go through, you know, Lord Eddard being killed. I already knew that was going to happen. From the beginning of this series, I already knew that was going to happen. And yet, when I saw that episode, it still got me. It still got to me. Because it just, they did it so well.
I know before I watched it. I watched it later than everybody else did. Everybody was already ranting about it online. But I went ahead and I was like, oh, crap, I got to see this. So I watched it, and yeah, it still got me. The way they did it, everything was awesome. Because up until that point, they lead you with such hope that he was actually going to be able to go and be on the wall with this bastard, you know?
Right.
And
I almost kind of watched it with that attitude of like, well, maybe he's going to make it this time. Maybe he won't really die.
Right. Like, I was of the same opinion. I was like, well, this looks great. I mean, you know, kind of cheesy, kind of like, oh, well, figures that they would go this route. You know what I mean? And then they fucking sliced his goddamn head off. And I was like, holy shit. And then I was cheering at the same time. I was like, thank you. Thank you for doing that to this character. Because there's no cheesy foreshadowing. There's no, like, well, he's the hero. He gets away from it. Da da da. No, fuck that. They kill him. Boom. Gone. Done. So, great job. I mean, it's... And if they would have kept him alive, one of the posters on the forums had stated that if they would have kept him alive, that would have changed the entire dynamic of the series. At that point in time, it would have completely diverged from the original story and books to create its own entity. And I think at that point, they would have fucked themselves over, you know? So,
well, because I think that doing that would have interfered with a lot of what makes this series so good. And that part of that springs from the fact that none of these characters are safe. Bad things could potentially happen to anybody.
Absolutely.
You know, not to say anything bad about other types of fantasy books or anything, because I like all different kinds of fantasy books, and I don't mind reading the books where you know that the hero is going to make it all the way through. But I like the fact that this series doesn't do that.
It's nice that when they show some balls.
Right. And if they had changed that for the TV series, it would have ruined that aesthetic for it.
Right. And like I said, it would have changed the entire dynamic of the show, because they wouldn't have been able to stick to the storylines or the writing stuck in the book.
Oh, no, because everything that happens after that sort of relies on Lord Eddard dying.
Right.
So, yeah, nothing that happens after would make any sense if he's still alive.
And like I said on my Facebook, I don't know if a lot of you people follow my Facebook or not, but if you're pissed this week, wait till next week.
Yeah. Yeah, like we said, nobody is safe.
Nobody is safe. Expect
more people to die.
Right. Like I said, dude, next week you're going to be pissed. And we're going to see the whole internet blow up there. Especially Otaku Assemble. He's like, you know, don't kill off this other character or else I'm quitting the show. Well, dude, you're about to quit the show. I'm sorry. yeah. So anyway, great job on the series. I think it's doing an amazing – they're doing an amazing job. So why don't we go ahead and take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll review some of the other things that we've seen or read this week.
Do you have dreams of world domination? You ever wanted to take on those pesky G.I. Joe jerk-offs but really didn't know how to do that? Visit www.cobrathirdnightwatch.com. This is Major Boca of Cobra asking you, telling you, to go to www.cobrathirdnightwatch.com. That's Cobra3RDNightwatch.com.
Okay, everybody, we're back. So we're going to take a little bit of time now to talk about the animated film Green Lantern, Emerald Knights.
Yay!
So AJ, what did you think?
I don't know. I was a little bit torn with this. A little bit torn. Green Lantern, Emerald Knights is a new DC animated film that was released this past week. Basically, it depicts a whole bunch of different story and origin stories on different Green Lanterns within the core. So I thought story-wise that was kind of cool, you know, being able to follow all that stuff. And The problem I had is that its continuity with the first Green Lantern animated was off. Like, they didn't do a good job with that, mixing things up. What I did like was the storytelling and the animation. I thought both of them were great. But another thing I didn't like was the voice acting. For example, Kilowog, it's Henry Rollins, but he sounded like a light-voiced wuss, whereas in the other one, in the other Green Lantern animated show movie that came out, he was voiced by Michael Madsen, and it kind of fit a little bit better. And even so, in the new movie coming out, Kilowog is voiced by Michael Clark Duncan, both deep-voiced individuals. Henry Rollins, while you would normally think he's deep-voiced, in this role, he wasn't. It was very high-pitched. So it was kind of confusing to me.
Yeah, there was something that I noticed between First Flight and Emerald Knights. They kept the character designs, but the change in the voice actors really kind of threw things off a little bit.
Yeah. I mean, it was nice to see Nathan Fillion. I mean, fans will finally get what they've been waiting for, and that's Neil.
That's who that was.
Nathan Fillion as Hal Jordan, Green Lantern. So I thought voice-wise, that fit great. I thought he did a great job with that. Jason Isaacs as Sinestro did a good job as well. But again, it still threw me off with Kilowog.
Yeah. I think that I enjoyed watching the movie for what it was. I think the issue that I had with it was mostly just that I thought that the sort of the main storyline that they had was kind of pointless.
Yeah.
To the rest of what else was going on. Like, it didn't need to be there. They could have found some other way to just do essentially like three small episodes within a film, which I enjoyed getting the backstory in a lot of these characters because I'm not really caught up on the Green Lantern story. So I don't know a whole lot of the history behind the Green Lantern Corps and stuff. So it was kind of interesting to see that. And then I went through and checked on like Wikipedia and stuff and, you know, got a little bit more in-depth information on it. But I liked it for that reason. But yeah, I did. It was kind of confusing to me, though, trying to figure out, like, I thought that the stories that they were talking about were supposed to be relevant to the situation that was going on in sort of like, you know, the what was considered the current timeline,
right,
in this story. But it nothing was really related to anything else that was going on. So that was a little confusing for me.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. I just, I don't know. I like the anthology part of it. I mean, it had the stories that were contained within it was the first Lantern, where they discuss having how the first one became the best one. A Kilowog side story depicting how he went through boot camp and what have you. Lara showing how this person went back and had to deal with her family. Mogo doesn't socialize, which I thought was pretty cool.
Right.
And funny thing that the main character in that story, Bolfunga, was voiced by Roddy Piper. So that was kind of cool. Abin Sur had a storyline in there, and that one was pretty cool as well. And the Emerald Knights, which is the main storyline throughout the whole thing. And that one I didn't get because I had Corona in there, who was like this big monster, huge character. And like Brian said, I'm not very familiar with the Green Lantern backstory. I haven't read all the Emerald Knights or what have you. I read part of the Blackest Night series, and I don't know. It felt like because I didn't know too much about the history that I was just lost. I didn't know who all these characters were, or much less I cared about them. The only character I ever really cared about was Kilowog. He was always my favorite character in the Green Lantern universe. So seeing this story, not knowing who Krona was, not seeing any type of backstory on that, on the character or why everyone is so fearful of him, it kind of took away from me. But the little side stories, the anthology stories that they had in there was, I thought they were awesome.
Yeah, I liked each of the side stories. And also, I really enjoyed the animation.
Yeah, the animation was really cool.
Like, everything came off really smooth, and it didn't seem that kind of, like, you know, like, weird, jerky kind of thing that a lot of times American animation kind of has that quality to it, where it seems like the movements are not very smooth.
Right.
But at least it wasn't, you know, like a Saturday morning, like Japanese.
Yeah, it wasn't Pokemon.
Like 4 frames. Yeah,
it wasn't Pokemon. It was really good, and I really appreciated the artwork, and I appreciated the movie too. Like I said, it was just that little bit that the main story just didn't matter to me. You know, it just I wish I would have had some backstory on that. That would have been nice.
Because when I first started watching it, like the little cold start that they have at the beginning where they sort of like lead up and the one chick, whoever that was, gets killed. And then it comes back in and it starts going to this other storyline. I'm like, wait, but you know, what about that other thing that happened? And then they kind of come back and deal with a little and then go into another story. And then I was like scratching my head trying to figure out just what exactly was supposed to be going on. Like, which story am I supposed to be following here?
Yeah, no, like it jumped all over the place a little bit. But still overall it was good. It's a nice little lead in to the Green Lantern movie, which is coming out tomorrow.
And I think it's definitely at least still worth adding to, you know, your DVD collection.
Right, right. Now, this film was the 7th in the DC Universe Animated Original Movie Direct-to-Video projects that they have had out. The first being, let me give you a short list of what movies they all are. And that way, if you haven't seen them, you can go collect them right away. Because they're all pretty good. Except for the first one, Superman Doomsday. I really didn't like that one. It just felt a little cheesy to me. Justice League The New Frontier. Had to be one of the best ones out there. Batman Gotham Knight, which was pretty cool. The Wonder Woman film, which we discussed on a previous show. Green Lantern First Flight, I really dug that one. That one was fairly epic. I thought they did an awesome job with that. Superman Batman Public Enemies, I love that one too. Justice League Crisis on Two Earths. Batman Under the Red Hood, which has to be one of my favorites right now. It's tied with another one. Superman Batman Apocalypse, which is good. All-Star Superman, which is the other one that is tied for favorites with Batman Under the Red Hood. And then this latest one, Green Lantern Emerald Knights. Future projects that you can expect to see, some of these have been pretty amped up, is Batman Year One, which will be an adaptation of Frank Miller's story, Batman Year One from 1987. It's the one Batman story that changed the dynamic of Batman comics. After that, he was no longer campy or cheesy or anything. He was pretty dark, and he's the Batman you know today.
Right.
Justice League Doom, which will be a loose adaptation of JLA Tower of Babel. That one, I can't give away too much. You have to watch it.
Yeah. Well, I'm not really familiar with JLA as it is anyway, so.
Yeah, well, this one is – okay, I'll give it away. Basically, Batman develops a file – on each member of the Justice League's weaknesses and how to kill them.
Okay, if they I've heard of this series, but I haven't actually read it. So
right, so this will be that. It's a loose adaptation, so they may change it. And it was written and adapted by Dwayne McDuffie before he passed away this year. Dwayne McDuffie, who did All-Star Superman. So, and the last one,
I'll definitely check it.
The last one is The Dark Knight Returns. Another adaptation of Frank Miller's work. So, I'm looking forward to those. Those would be awesome.
DC has really been sort of generally knocking them out of the park.
Yeah, they're doing really good. I mean, where Marvel is slipping, DC is stepping it up. So, yeah, pretty excited to see these ones coming out. So, all right, Brian, if you had nothing else to add about the Emerald Knights, why don't we go ahead and take a quick break? When we come back, we can talk about the comics that we've been reading.
Greetings, Forbidden Panel Knights. This is Benjamin Gleibert, Director of Publishing for Symantec, San Diego's premium comic book publisher and home of Mythoi and the webcomic The Undergrounds. Check us out online at Symantec.com. That's Symantec.com. For now, enjoy your geeky gurus, AJ and Brian. Symantec Publishing. Find the meaning in print.
And we're back, and it's time for a little bit of comic reviews. And I actually have managed to read something, so I've got a few comics to talk about.
And it's not Blue Water.
No, it's not Blue Water. I went on a little bit of a zombie kick this time around, so... sorry, guys, it's all going to be about zombies.
Dang, because you know how much we don't like zombie comics here at Forbidden Panel.
Well, anybody that's listening to this probably doesn't care. The first one I'm going to talk about is just a one-shot graphic novel called Zombies Calling. It was written and illustrated by Faith Erin Hicks and published by Slave Labor Graphics. And it's pretty much a standard fare sort of slave labor type of indie subculture type comic where, you know, it's geared more towards like the younger sort of like hip, like emo, goth, whatever crowd. A little bit of a Scott Pilgrim influence to this. It's kind of like a, you know, in terms of like cultural references and, you know, I guess things of that nature. Did kind of seem like I was a little bit outside of the demographic for the comic, but I found it entertaining nonetheless. Basically, what the story is about is a trio of young college kids in England, not in England, I'm sorry, in Canada, that are obsessed with zombie movies. In particular, there's a girl named Joss who is trying to essentially learn all of the rules for staying alive in a zombie apocalypse by gleaning these sort of like overarching rules for various zombie movies. And the rest of her friends all think that she's a little bit nuts because she wants to, you know, basically figure out how to stay alive during a zombie apocalypse, and they all know that there's no such thing as zombies.
It sounds almost like the I Killed Giants.
Yeah, there's a little bit of that in there. Not quite as heavy, though, in terms of, like, her friends don't really, you know, there's not anybody being cruel to her because she believes that. So, you know, it's more of just like her friends kind of just like, you know, friendly ridicule type thing. But essentially, she ends up finding out during the course of the comic that there really is a zombie invasion. And in the process, turns to her list of the rules of zombie movies to try to stay alive. And so it's a little bit of a tongue-in-cheek look at the whole zombie genre. You know, it kind of pokes fun, kind of in a similar way that Shaun of the Dead did, where, you know, it takes a lot of the cliches from various zombie movies and then sort of plays with those. And in this case, with the character Joss literally having a list of all the things that people do wrong in zombie movies in order to stay alive. And so, yeah, it was just it was a short series, and I quite enjoyed it. I mean, it's not the greatest zombie comic I've ever read, but it was pretty good for what it was.
And not as good as ZKS?
Well, I'm a little bit biased when it comes to that, so my opinion might not be quite legitimate. But, you know, I mean, it really, I would say it doesn't compare to a lot of other zombie comics in the fact that, you know, it doesn't really take itself seriously. Like, the whole point of the comic is to kind of poke fun at zombies and while still being very appreciative of the zombie genre. So I think it really succeeds in what it's trying to do.
Awesome.
And yeah, it's entertaining. It's fun. I actually really like the art style that Faith Erin Hicks has. It's sort of cartoony, but it fit with the theme of the comic well, and I liked her character designs. Like, the characters were all sort of interesting, and like I like it when characters all have like a similar style in terms of the way that they look overall throughout the comic, but are still individually recognizable. There's one thing that I can't stand when it comes to comics is when all of the characters all just kind of look the same with different hair. You know, the sort of like anime syndrome.
Right.
So the characters are all designed really well. And, you know, the art in general, I liked it. I mean, the girl that drew this comic definitely has talent when it comes to drawing.
And who does the writing and the art again?
Faith Erin Hicks. She both wrote and illustrated the book.
Oh, nice.
So what about you? What have you been reading?
Well, I've been reading a different, you know, an eclectic group of different comics. The first of being I don't know how to describe this one. You know, I've talked about on the show before previously about a writer artist named Jeff Lemire.
Right.
Jeff Lemire, who wrote one of my top 20 comic books called The Nobody, and is currently writing Sweet Tooth. Discussed how, you know, his writing and his art style are really great and pretty messed up. So I picked up one of the I picked up the trilogy that he's most famous for, called Essex County Trilogy, and gave it a read, and immediately regretted it afterwards.
That bad?
No, it's, how do I put this? Fucked up. So, Essex County Trilogy is basically comprised of three stories. First one being Tales from the Farm. Then there's Ghost Stories and the Country Nurse. All these stories depict life in the fictional county, Essex County. Well, not fictional, but real county called Essex County. But fictional depictions of
right.
individuals' lives as they go on through living in this place. Without getting too deep into it, because it would just give it away. These stories are just phenomenal. They had me crying in public at a coffee shop while I was reading them, if that tells you anything about how good they are. Real down-to-earth, very, very few fantasy settings. The first story involving, you know, this kid meets this other guy, an older gentleman who used to be a hockey player, now works at a gas station. And together they, you know, go on adventures, imaginative adventures, where they're fighting aliens and trying to stop an invasion from happening. And the child has superpowers. And that's about all that happens in as far as the fantasy aspect of it goes. Everything else, it's kind of like I Killed Giants, as I had discussed earlier, where all that fantasy is basically designed to cover up what's really happening in his life. And what's really happening in his life is pretty messed up. That's the Tales from the Farm. Ghost Stories picks up right afterwards and depicts almost the same thing that's happening, but from different viewpoints, going further deeper into the history of all the characters involved and how they all tie together. The same with the Country Nurse. So Jeff Lemire does a great job in like pacing, writing, and drawing in these things, and that the drawing is almost simplistic, and I don't want to say that in an insulting fashion. But it's almost simplistic in that you're able to appreciate what the point he's trying to make that goes along with the storyline and the writing. So he does an amazing job, and I curse him for it because again, it made me feel emotion, more emotion than I needed to feel reading a comic book. It's one of those comic book series where you read it and you're like, "This isn't a funny book. This isn't. There's no superheroes in this. This is real. Why am I reading real? This is bullshit." You know, it's that kind of trilogy, and it does a great, amazing job. And Brian, I can't stress this enough that you need to read it, because damn it, I don't want to be the only one crying in public.
I know. You've told me a number of times.
So, and, pick it up, damn it.
I'm sure I probably will.
The book was put out in 2008. It was put out by Top Shelf Productions, who seems to be putting out, I mean, they're basically a mirror image of Forbidden Panel that they're putting out, independent published properties that, you know, need to hit the mainstream or somehow get the word out there, and they're doing a great job with the titles that they have. So Essex County being one of the first ones they put out. It's available now in collected editions. So if you get a chance, pick it up. But the main reason behind why I read this, other than being a fan of Jeff Lemire, is because the books have been picked up and auctioned off to be a new TV series. So, you know, I picked them up because I wanted to get to learn more whether or not this is going to be another shitty Smallville or what have you. But having read the stories, man, it's going to fuck people up. This is the new Game of Thrones, but in more of a reality-based setting. So, and I'm glad I picked it up. There you have it. Essex County Trilogy, done by Jeff Lemire, put out by Top Shelf Comics. Definite worth a read. Brian?
So the next thing I'm going to talk about is 28 Days Later, which I guess some people might argue is not strictly a zombie, but whatever. I think it counts as part of the whole zombie genre. Specifically, I started reading the 28 Days Later comic series and not the 28 Days Later graphic novel. So this one, essentially, the point I'm at right now picks up sort of like almost like a direct sequel to the 28 Days Later movie, in that it starts detailing the events that happen after the end of the film.
Is this the one that I had previously reviewed where I stated I was mad at how the guy was portraying the characters and how they're stupid?
Could very possibly be.
Awesome. Were you able to read more than one issue? I had to stop at
yes.
one.
Yeah, I read the first four issues.
Ah, well, that is a testament to your patience, my friend. Continue on. I'm interested to see how you felt about it.
I personally didn't really have any problems with it, because the only character that really returns that I can remember from the original film is Selena.
Right.
And I don't recall whatever happened to Cillian Murphy's character at the end of the movie. I don't remember if he lived or died, but
depending on what ending you saw.
Yeah. So, yeah, he doesn't return. So it's basically just, I mean, Selena's really the only character that's coming back, and then the rest of them are all characters that were created for the series. And I found it interesting just in terms of them sort of expanding on the events of 28 Days Later and kind of leading up to the events of the film 28 Weeks Later. I have to say that I was happy at first to see the return of Selena, because she was one of the characters that I liked the most from the movie. But yeah, I mean, she's just kind of bland in this series. I mean, I wasn't really upset or anything about it. Like, it wasn't enough of a change that it really bothered me. But I don't know. I guess maybe just without the performance of the actress behind it, it just doesn't really feel like the same character.
Yeah, from what I remember, I didn't, you know, I wasn't too impressed with it. And the characters just felt, I don't know, one-dimensional. But that's just me.
Yeah, there's been a little bit of character development, but most of the development, like in terms of the pacing and everything, seems like it's mostly focused on the story and the details of what happened and what caused the plague. Like, they start filling in a little bit more than that. The rest of the characters that are around really haven't been developed too far, at least as I'm only in the first four issues of this series. So, yeah, I mean, I'll probably continue to keep reading this series. I wasn't as sorely disappointed with it as you were, but the characters, at least the character Selena, doesn't feel the same as from the movie, so. As far as the artwork goes, I think I actually like the artwork more than I like the actual comic itself. Like, I like that sort of, like, kind of gritty, rough art style.
Okay. Would you recommend it?
Yeah, especially, I mean, if anybody's a fan of 28 Days Later, I would recommend that they pick it up and give it a read. You know, I tend to be a little picky when it comes to certain aspects of comics, so people might not notice the things that I have an issue with.
Other than Blue Water.
Yeah, I will never ever recommend somebody read a Blue Water comic, but people do anyway.
See, that's where I have to draw an opposition with you, and I'll get into more detail on that later on in the episode. So, why don't we go ahead and take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll finish up our review section.
This is Brian of the Forbidden Panel Podcast. I just want to invite you to listen to my companion podcast, The Geek Girls, featuring one-on-one interviews with geeky ladies. Look for Geek Girls on ForbiddenPanel.com. All right, we're back. So, AJ, what else have you read?
Actually, I've read a couple of cool new stories, one of them being a, I wouldn't say new story, but a new arc on a familiar character, and that is Daredevil Reborn. Daredevil Reborn is a 4-issue comic book limited series that was put out by Marvel Comics this year. It follows the events of Shadowland, where Matt Murdock has to leave Hell's Kitchen behind. The story details about Matt entering Mexico's town, entering Mexico Town's incident. The series was released in 2011. It's written by Andy Diggle. Here's the basic plot line I'm pulling from Wiki. While walking away from New York, Matt arrives in a diner outside a small Mexican town where he helps a young blind boy fend off some bullies. He gives him advice on how to cope with his disability, only to be turned away by the hostile local police. Unable to overcome his curiosity, Matt follows them and discovers a mass grave outside the city, along with a large amount of secret weapons. When it comes to Daredevil, I'm a little temperamental in my whether or not I like him. It depends on the storyline and how he's depicted. Shadowland showed him as being overcome by this evil and basically blocking off all of Hell's Kitchen and committing some atrocious acts to which he needed to atone for. At the end of Shadowland, he basically regained his sanity and his self-awareness and realized of all the crimes and atrocities that he had committed during this time and decides to leave Hell's Kitchen behind and started to walk the earth. Just walk around and just get his head straight and figure out where he belongs in life. Very similar to many other stories that you've heard, the Hulk being predominantly the most predominant, as well as Kung Fu and what have you. I picked up this series because I thought maybe it would show him walking along and becoming involved in different things that happened on his journeys, almost like Preacher or Superman a couple years ago, where Superman decided to just walk around the United States and figure out, you know, be available for everybody. It disappointed me to find out that this was only a 4-issue limited series. It felt very lazy in that aspect, in that, you know, instead of taking a great character who would have walked around and you know, had little side adventures or whatever, and even further helped develop this character into turning back into who he was in that Daredevil, discovering his identity and whatnot, they decided to cheat their way and only create a 4-issue series where he walks into one town, has one adventure, and then decides it's back to New York and becoming Daredevil again. Woo! So in that aspect, I was very disappointed. Again, feeling like they shortcutted themselves and they got very lazy in it. However, this is a very compelling story. Daredevil's little side stories often are, beginning with like Father or Daredevil Ninja, what have you. They're great little jaunts into the personalization of Matt Murdock and Daredevil, and allows you to enjoy these adventures without having to pick up the main series of the book. So I enjoyed Daredevil Reborn on that aspect. I thought the story was intriguing. I thought the art was phenomenal. I even liked his new look where he let the facial hair grow and he looks a little scraggly and what have you. What I didn't like was how easy he slid back into the Daredevil lifestyle, so much as borrowing a police SWAT team outfit and daredeviling it, you know, so that he felt more comfortable jumping around. It seemed almost ridiculous because at this point in the Marvel continuity, Matt Murdock, his identity is publicly known as Daredevil. Everybody knows that they are one and the same. So I didn't understand that part. But otherwise, I thought the book was pretty good. So yeah, if you get a chance, man, pick it up. Let me know what you think. It's written by Andy Diggle and Anthony Johnston, with arts done by David Gianfelice and coloring by Matt Hollingsworth, put out by Marvel. So yeah, there you have it. Brian, what you got?
The only other thing that I've read is the latest issue of The Walking Dead. So, again, this one sort of is not quite as powerful as the last issue, but still, I think, really important in terms of the character development. Basically, we already spoiled it last time in that, you know, Carl ends up getting injured, is on the brink of death. This latest issue sort of deals with the aftermath of everything that happens with the zombies finally overrunning their city and, you know, killing off a bunch of the people that were there, and the injuring of Carl, as well as the death of I can't remember the woman's name.
Yeah.
But the woman that Rick lets die during the invasion of the zombies. Denise, I think, was her name. Something. But anyways, whatever, she's dead, so it doesn't matter what her name was. But this one, yeah, like I said, the story was a little bit slower. It wasn't one of those oh fuck issues. But it definitely was really important in terms of, especially for the development of Rick. Like, in this issue, Rick decides that he's like, you know what? No, fuck this. I'm tired of losing things. I want to keep what we've got, and we're going to fight. We're going to keep the city. We're not going to leave because the zombies got in. We're going to fix the problems that we have. We're going to man up, and we're going to keep what we've got and not let the zombies or someone else take it from us ever again.
Right.
And so I thought that was actually a really good turning point for the characters, because they've been, you know, wandering around from place to place to place and essentially, you know, losing all of their members and basically losing everything that they've ever had along the way. Like, these people have lost so much to the point where, you know, I mean, they're all a little unsettled. They're never really going to be normal. But Rick finally decides that, you know, I'm going to stop just letting things happen to me, and I'm going to start being proactive and start stopping things from happening to us again.
You know, Walking Dead continues to impress me every month. Every time it comes out, like, each issue is just, it just seems better than the last issue. You know, the way that the writing is portraying what's going right on, and the characterizations, the development of each of these characters is becoming more and more, I'm beginning to relate to these people now. You know, having read the series for this long, I can see how Rick's point of view is, and I can see everybody else's point of view and what they would think and how they would react at this point. So, right, you know, I think Kirkman's doing a great job with the writing, and never had a bad thing to say about this series mm-hmm. so far.
Well, I think it's a testament, too, that even in the episode where, you know, the whole world isn't basically falling down around the characters, it's still a really good, really interesting, I keep saying episode, but, you know.
Well, it feels like that. It's issue, very episodic. Whatever. The series is very episodic, it is. You know.
But, you know, I think it's a testament that the fact that even when it's just a lot of characters sort of internal dialogue and sort of dealing with the aftermath of this big situation, it's still fascinating, and it still continues to be one of the best written comics out there.
Yeah. We're slowly converting the show over to the Robert Kirkman cast.
Yeah. It's basically, you know, in the next few episodes, we're just going to be the Robert Kirkman variety hour.
Yeah, so expect that. Episode 86, nothing but Kirkman. So, anyway, yeah, so issue 85 was really good. I find it amusing that it's caught up to our show, the count.
Issue. Yeah.
But, you know, hey.
We're going to end up getting lapped by Walking Dead here pretty soon.
I know, huh? Which means we need to keep recording. So going on to the last book series that I started, because it is not finished yet, Jennifer Blood. The series is put out by Dynamite, and it depicts Jennifer Fellows, a mild-mannered housewife by day, efficient assassin by night. She is no regular hired assassin, however, as she's picking her own targets for no profit, and is apparently revenging herself upon her criminal gang of uncles. The ultra-violent series is a mix of action and dark humor, and, as writer Garth Ennis admits in his first issue letter to the readers, is his overdue return to the style of writing that he's known for and has longed to write for some time, after the last few years of his creative output had to take in a decidedly more serious turn. Basically, for those of you that are not familiar with Ennis, having put out Preacher and really has a sick, disgusting sense of detailing things, he's been wrapped up in the Battlefield series, which Brian, once again, it seems like every episode of the panel cast, I'm reminding you that you need to read this series in Battlefields. He's decided to go back and be Garth Ennis. He decided to go back and be himself. So with this series, he's doing that. Jennifer Blood is an awesome series so far. It's only 3 issues in. I'm not sure how far it's going to go, but I've read all 3 issues and I thoroughly enjoy it. So if you get a chance, you need to read it as well. Again, it's put out by Dynamite Books, written by Garth Ennis. Can't remember who does the art on it. I believe it's Ariando Batista. But it has a slew of variant covers that look really gorgeous, would make nice little pinups and what have you. So, pick it up. I told you it's good. You should not be doubting me. Brian?
Well, I doubt you on a regular basis, so. But I'll probably pick it up.
I doubt your commitment to Sparkle Motion.
Okay. Well, why don't we go ahead and take a quick break, and then we'll be right back.
Awesome.
Hi, this is Justin White of Necrosapien Press and artist of ZKS, the Zombie Kill Squad. And you should come check out ForbiddenPanel.com for all your latest geek needs.
Hey everybody, welcome back to the show, episode 85 of the Panelcast. Well, that about wraps it up for us on this week's episode. Again, we apologize for the length of time between episodes. We're going to try and get this back on the weekly schedule. You may be seeing some change in the format. You may be seeing some added bonuses coming up here soon. We're very excited with all the stuff that's going on, not just with Panelcast, but with Forbidden Panel as well.
Yeah, a lot of big things, a lot of big ideas.
Yeah. If you haven't had a chance, please check out our new monthly webcomic, AdamIsWatching.com. It's a collection of different artists that are contributing into the webcomic, so it's going to be pretty cool and awesome, and I'm very excited for it. Want to thank everybody that showed up for the Super Bad Action Figures grand opening this past week. We thought it was very successful. Super Bad Action Figures is an amazing store full of just geek wonderment. It's a statue store, a collectible store, what have you. And I make sure I leave my wallet in the car every time I go over there. Otherwise, I'd be flat broke, even more than I am now.
Yeah, I'm sorry I missed it.
Stay tuned because we have some great announcements coming up for the Inland Empire Comic Expo coming out on September 4th. I can't get too deep into it, but just letting you know, man, it's going to be bigger and better than the last show. And it's going to be just have a lot more awesome guests and be a lot more fun. Find us all over the place, CKS, ZombieKillSquad.net, ForbiddenPanel.com. You can download our show off of iTunes. All over the place. Thanks, everybody, for tuning in. Brian, did you have anything to say before we boogied out?
Thanks for listening.
Brian, man, a few words. All right, guys, so we'll catch you next week, hopefully. Thanks again for tuning in.
Panelcast is brought to you by Forbidden Panel. Please visit us at www.forbiddenpanel.com.